You're listening to a ComicsXF podcast.
WMQA.
Hello and welcome to WMQA, the ComicsXF interview podcast where two best friends talk about comics with the people who make them. I'm Dan Grote.
And I'm Matt Lazowitz.
And this week's guest is a longtime friend of the pod and the principal mind behind Death of Comics Bookcase Volume 1, now backable on Kickstarter, Zach Quaintance. Welcome, Zach.
Hey, thanks for having me, guys. Really appreciate it. You know, this is actually the first podcast I was ever a guest on, so it's pretty cool to all these years later be returning yet again.
Oh shit, look at that, coming full circle, six years later, yeah. Whatever it was.
Yeah, something like that. I've lost a lot of money making comics since then, so it's been a run.
you know what they say, operate out of loss until you make it.
That's right. It's like investing in a small business. It's been fun. I mean, that's the point. There's worse things to spend money on than like hiring super cool artists to collaborate with you and give them a page rate so it's not weird and where you're like, you know, feel like you're taking advantage of someone or something, you know.
Well, let's get into that, man. You're here to promote Death of Comics Bookcase Volume 1, an anthology featuring stories by yourself and Nick Cagnetti, PJ Holden, Luke Horseman, Ryan Lee, Anna Riedman, and Pat Scott, and with a cover by John McCrae, live now on Kickstarter. How did this all get started? What is the origin of this project?
Well, it's like there's six different stories in the book, and five of them are sort of these like individual, like largely self-contained stories. And so they really started as individual pieces. Like actually two of them were pitches I'd been working on for a while, like tinkering with. And so I started to make those around this time last year. There was a horror pitch and a fantasy pitch I was sort of working on simultaneously. And I was making those and just thinking like, man, like I'm really proud of these things. I would love for people to see them, even if, like, you know, the market's tough or whatever 100 reasons pitches don't get picked up necessarily. And so I had it in my mind that, like, hey, maybe like as I'm pitching these, I could also kind of put together a self anthology where I write all the things. And so I started working on extra pieces. Like the third one I started working on them was the superhero piece with Nick, who I'd become kind of friendly with seeing at shows and stuff. And then after I had a couple, I started to get this idea that, like, you know, it'd be really funny to like tie them together with something in between. And as you well know, I used to run this blog, Comics Bookcase, and part of that was being obsessively on Twitter about it. And people, like, I would tweet like I and me, like in the first person frequently about like my life around comics. And people would often like call me Mr. Bookcase or like make light of the fact that I was actually a bookcase. And so that like had stuck in my head. So when I needed like a framing device for these shorts, I was like, what if it was Mr. Bookcase was the guy sort of doling out these stories? And that's how the whole thing. And then I'd also sort of stop doing my website. And if you're going to stop doing a website, why not publicly execute it for everyone's enjoyment? So that's how it all started falling into place.
I mean, I just let the domain lapse, but go off, you know?
Yeah. No, that would be the financially prudent move because I have kept the domain for whatever reason. Yeah, so that's it. That's it. I'm killing this thing. I'm killing this comics bookcase.
Right on. Now for you, what are some of your favorite anthologies?
You know, I really like the old EC Comics sort of, I mean, who doesn't, right? Like those horror kind of shorts. And I really like the like recent anthology resurgence. I feel like we've seen a little bit like Creepshow doing it really well. DC Comics has sort of re-embraced like with their Brave and the Bold books. I feel like there's another big one I'm missing, but I've always just liked the format. And one thing I've always really liked about that is when they sort of have little connections between the stories. Like that was something I tried to do with this. Like the first story, the one that Anna Redmond drew, was a horror story featuring a werewolf priest. And if you look closely, you'll notice in the superhero comic, Nick's superhero character out of costume is reading a Werewolf Priest comic. So I tried to do little things like that to take advantage of the so it wouldn't feel so separate. Like there was little through lines going through it, and the bookcase makes jokes about the stories as they kind of progress. So I try to do like an anthology that reads connected, if that makes sense.
One thing I will say about, anthologies now, I mean, obviously, Marvel's got its Voices series, so it's very into kind of working with, the anthologies with like Black creators in February and queer creators in June and all that. DC does that too, but what they also do that I love is they've created this mini cottage industry of anthologies with incredible punny names. So, for example, their February special was How to Lose a Guy Gardner in 10 Days. Fantastic. I can never get mad at it. I think there was one, oh my God, it was a Christmas one. I want to say it was like end of 22. Matt, you're gonna have to help me. It was like Grifter got run over by a reindeer.
Yes,
That's what it
it was.
was. Like all the characters in your canon, and we're going with Grifter, and I'm just like I can hear Matthew Rosenberg whispering in whatever editor's ear was working on that book at the time.
We just got Ape Rill
That's right, yeah.
with the Legion of Doom. Woo, woo, Which is actually how it is written out.
That's leaning in very hard. That's also that timeless comics truism of if you put apes on in a book, it will sell.
Funny you should mention that, because I put apes in this book.
Yes.
One of the story, and not satisfied with that, I also added sharks to the ape story and put them in a helicopter. So I could have had dinosaurs in there, but it was already getting pretty loaded with my favorite comics things. Use a little restraint.
Well, look, it's only volume one. There's time. But this is the point where I turn to my co-host and I say, Matt, question applies to you as well. Favorite anthologies?
Well, I mean, Zach mentioned the classic EC horror stuff, and even beyond the horror stuff, the suspense stuff too, the Conagher Impact, which has probably my favorite single EC short, Master Race by Robert Conagher, about a guy who's in the subway and he keeps seeing someone, he's remembering the concentration camps, and in the end it turns out he's the guard and the
Oh
guy
yeah.
who's chasing him, or who's is one of the victims, and it's does that beautiful EC twist ending thing. But Conagher just draws it incredibly put together. But that, and especially the first volume, but I've generally enjoyed it throughout. But Batman Black and White, they're always just great. But that first volume of Batman Black and White, which is just, you look at it's from the mid 90s, and it's got these creators that were, I mean, the big names at the time, but also some creators from earlier days. I mean, Archie Goodwin's in there, Denny O'Neil, Walt Simonson, who granted was big earlier and is still to this day, but Alex Toth doing pinups,
Oh, yeah.
Miller doing pinups, Jim Lee's first big major DC work is covers on that, on one of those. I don't think Lee ever did much DC before that. I mean, McFarlane did, but not. But it's this incredible anthology. Brian Boland writing and drawing, in particularly creepy story. But yeah, I mean, Batman Black and White is just always a winner, up to and including the ones in the back of Brave and the Bold now. Brave and the Bold now.
Yeah, I've seen some of the pages of was it Zach Thompson with working with Ashley Wood, and those look gorgeous.
Oh yeah, that was this week as we were recording, or the previous week into this week, and
Time.
really just gorgeous looking.
So, Zach, I read another interview with you about Death of Comics Bookcase where you said, and I quote, "At no point did I think to myself, okay, time to make this funny." Was there any point that you looked at the jokes or the humor that crept into the scripts and thought, should I dial this back?
No, like it never occurred to me at any point that like that like maybe I was shooting myself in the foot, especially in the horror one, like which with putting too much humor in it. I guess just because I sort of have a preference, I think comics should be funny, or like they don't, not that they have to be, but I enjoy a good laugh while reading comics. So while I was doing it, like it wasn't a matter of like wanting to dial back humor. It was just making sure that like whatever jokes found their way in kind of earned their way in. Like the jokes that ended up in this thing definitely weren't the first jokes that had tried to find their way in, if that makes sense. Like there were plenty that needed to be dialed back just because they weren't funny. And I hope people don't read it and think that like, yeah, maybe he should have dialed it back a little more. But I was pretty selective about that. I can credit my partner for that a little bit, because like she's always been a great influence on like when you're trying to be funny in writing, maybe don't, like maybe let it happen inadvertently, because that's when it when humor really pops, you know. But no, I never checked my impulse to make a joke with this thing. In a way, it's like when I was making these shorts, it sort of felt abstract that anyone would ever like read them at that point, you know, when you're just kind of like scripting for pitches, like you feel like there's like 8 million steps before another human being will ever evaluate this. So have some fun with it, right? Like you're doing it for you to an extent.
So this is a bigger project than your last Kickstarter for Nextdoor. What are you doing bigger this time in terms of promotion or maybe just stress eating?
Yeah, no, I have a killer, thank you for asking about that. I have a killer stress headache, and I've been eating like a horse. Like I've just been eating everything. But yeah, I'm doing everything bigger. The last, like, it's just such a different project. The last Kickstarter, if people don't know, it was a pandemic summer Kickstarter. It was kind of a neighborhood slice of life crime comic that a friend of mine and I cooked up. It wasn't very deliberate. It started as a 5-page short for fun, because he wanted practice drawing everyday people and everyday things. Like he'd mostly done sci-fi and fantasy, and I was like, I could write a really kind of subtle crime comic. And then got bigger and bigger. We wanted to get it colored. We wanted to get it printed. So we took it to Kickstarter. And I had no idea what to expect. Everything I did to promote that was sort of like happenstance. It was like after, I mean, I did very little by way of preparation before that thing launched. This time, like, man, I've been thinking about like how to do this since like last summer, really. So I've been in pre-launch for 6 weeks. I've done stuff like make videos that I've put all over Instagram, just whatever to get the word out. Leveraged my old newsletter audience from my website, much to the chagrin of like 40 some people who instantly unsubscribed when I started talking about it. But yeah, and you know, I just feel like now also, like last time I did it, I was like a Twitter personality, sort of like a comics Twitter personality. I was on there all the time being like, hey gang, let's talk about this month's solicits. Now I would eat glass before I would do that. Like I'm just kind of like disengaged wholly from spending all my time on social media, in part to work on making these comics. Like I found it sort of like a big boost for my productivity when I stopped that like constant Twitter personality development. But that comes, it makes it a little more complicated, right? Because like people are less likely to help you promote on Twitter if you're not like on there a lot. Like some people remember me from a few years ago and they've helped been really helpful, which is nice. But like, yeah, and I mean, I'm sure you've noticed Twitter is very different now, and maybe not as easy to have things get any traction. So like, I've really had to think outside the box, like do it, like doing those videos, and like I started a TikTok account, which is something I swore I would never do. Been questionably effective. I don't know how to gauge whether that's work. So yeah, man, I'm just trying everything, like throwing everything at the wall, seeing what sticks. I've already identified like some other Kickstarter campaigns that I like right now, and like reached out to the other creators, been like, hey, I really like your campaign, I'm backing it. Like I think we probably help each other promote. Like, if you want to do recommendations, I'm game. Like, I'm gonna recommend yours. Here's my link. Like, feel free to recommend mine. Like, so whatever it takes, man. It's all I've been thinking about lately. Talk about the stress eating too, if you want. Like,
If you want.
yeah. Well, this weekend was a banner stress eating weekend. There was Shake Shack on Friday.
Ooh.
Saturday night went to like a seafood restaurant, did oysters. It's pretty indulgent. And then yesterday we went to brunch and I had chicken and waffles. So it's just what a weekend.
Listen, you got to treat yourself. It's very important.
Yeah, no, I know. And yeah, and it's like I've had to like embrace, like I've been playing a lot of video games in the lead up to this. Like I just need to like carve out like an hour and a half to not think about it somehow. So eating has been helpful. Video games, like whatever, you know, playing with the dog.
Dog is always good. So the titular bookcase in this comic is this ornate anthropomorphic Beauty and the Beast looking piece of furniture with this wild tongue and three eyeballs, a friendly thing born of nightmare fuel. Why not one of those Billy bookcases from IKEA?
That's a great question. Like, so I'll just tell you how the bookcase was developed. Like, first of all, like I of all the stories I wrote in this thing, like I remember like trying to find an artist for the bookcase and just being like, man, like how in the world am I ever gonna find another human being who wants to like draw a walking, talking, anthropomorphic personification of my defunct comics blog that is that terrifies a bunch of teenagers. Like, who would ever want to do that? But luckily, first try, my first pick was Ryan Lee, who drew Mountain Head, the John Lee's book, which is like, I think is an incredibly underrated book over the last 5, 6 years. And I love that comic from like right when it came out, and I'd been revisiting it for whatever reason. I think because I joined Blue Sky and John was really active on there, and I was like, you know what, I should reread Mountain Head. And it occurred to me that like that book has monsters and it has like teenagers, which is some like interest, like fun looking designs for kids, which is something you don't see in a lot of American comics, you know. And I noticed Ryan had been doing a lot of Rick and Morty stuff, and I was like, maybe he'll get it, you know. And like I remember him emailing me back like all caps, like I really want to draw this, and I was like, oh hell yeah. Like but he brought like so much to the bookcase. Like I think I described it as like a living bookcase that was kind of scary. And I sent him a picture of the anthropomorphic chair from Pee-wee's Playhouse. Like the it probably had a name. Like I don't do
Cherry.
either.
Yeah, I was
Was
going
it
to say.
Cherry? Okay, I was, yeah, this is probably Cherry. so I sent him a screen cap of that and was like, it's like this, but sad, like sadder. It's like a sadder figure. And he brought the rest of it to it, like the three eyes, which he does this is a hilarious bit where he gives it glasses, like three panel glasses, cracked me up. And he made it ornate. I mean, I described the house as like a creepy old house, so like maybe it's making it like sort of your grandma's mutant bookcase was more fitting with that than like IKEA or like some kind of like postmodern one of those bookcases that like stacks or something weird. I don't know. But I remember him saying that like the thing he really had to work on was sort of the physicality of the bookcase, because the bookcase like gets up to a lot. Like it's not just standing still. It like runs, falls downstairs, like does a slide stop in a doorway at one point. Like, and so he sent me this, and you can find it on his Twitter if you're interested. He sent me like the character design, but instead of it just being like the character standing there and then like in profile with a head, it was like the bookcase sort of like strutting and dancing. Like there's like six different angles of the bookcase like twisting around and throwing its arms in the air. It was really funny. But he just brought so much to it, man. I've been trying to like, I want someone to interview him about what it was like on his end to get this script about like, hey, it's a sad mutant bookcase that's going to die, and it has to like do all these gymnastics. So like, figure that out. Like, I'd love to hear his like side of this, because for me, it's all fun. Like, I just send him a little script and it comes back like magic. But I'm sure for him, it took a lot of work. Yeah.
All right, you got a whole month of promotion ahead of you, so that's an
Yeah,
idea.
right. Yeah. No, yeah. I'll try to pin him down on that. He may never want to talk about it again. No, he's been great with it. But
Were there like a number of like, did it go through a few different designs before the final thing came through?
I mean, not I, we had that. We had an email exchange about it ahead of time. So by the time it actually came back with the bookcase, like it looked good. Like the first designs I saw, I loved. So no, I didn't really have any notes on his sort of first take on it. But like I said, we'd sort of like interacted around it, and I'd sent those Pee-wee's photo, and like a list of adjectives, like sad, scary, tragic, tragicomic was probably the underlined one. But no, he nailed it. And the kids were really funny too. Like, we went like heavy 80s teen gang vibe. I think the like description for the for one of them was like, this character is Molly Ringwald. and he like gave one of them the Back to the Future life preserver, which that was really funny. So yeah, like I don't know. I just that story to me, like I've looked over it I don't know how many times. It still puts a big smile on my face. Like we did it. And like it's filled with so many self deprecating jokes I feel like you only get if you tried to run your own comics website. Like maybe the six of us out here have done that. Like really appreciate the stuff about the different doors you can open. Like one of them's like respected journalist, another one's comics blogger, and the other one's like YouTuber, TikToker, and one of the kids is like, well, he's way too old for this one. So it's like a shot at myself.
That you got a good chuckle out of that one.
Yeah, right. Like I said, I started a TikTok to promote this. I'm like, I don't even know what's going on in this platform. Like it just bounces from some guy that's like, look how I renovated this door, to another guy that's like, look at this weird thing I ate. And it's just like chaos. Chaotic stimulants. Just chain of random video images. People like it, I guess. I'm sounding so old at this point. Like no one under 30 is gonna want to check out this comic. Like,
Zach, you're the youngest person on this Zoom call.
am I really? No
Oh,
kidding.
yeah.
All
I turned 44 at the end of this month.
right, I'm a little bit younger. I'm not 25 or anything,
You're
but
still
yeah.
in the target demographic for most things.
I mean, yeah,
Wait
I had a
now.
pretty
Wait
good
now,
handle
20
on
to 45.
Instagram.
Everyone cares about my opinion.
Yeah. Well, I'll enjoy it while it lasts for now. So,
There it is. So I thought it would be a good idea to go through each artist on this list and talk about the story that you worked on together, how you connected with them or got them to contribute to the project, and maybe something that you learned from them or something they did to surprise you while working with them. So I wanted to start with the artist who drew your A cover, John McCrae, the guy who co-created Freaking Hitman.
Hitman,
How?
yeah. yeah, so that was really simple how I connected with him. PJ Holden's friends with him and was like as we were working on the Apes and Sharks piece, was like, hey, I don't know if you'd be interested, but I think John might be available to do a cover or something for the book. And I was like, well, like play it cool, play it cool. Oh yeah, I might be interested. Maybe I'll shoot him an email. He's like, please do. So I did, and he was available. Like he was like just had time and was looking for commissions and covers and things he could knock out. This was before the holidays, so maybe it was like a holiday thing or whatever. But like, yeah, I mean, I was, and it's like it's hard to be starstruck over email, but I feel like I was like phrasing things weird and stuff, like as we were trying to like figure out logistics. But yeah, that was amazing. Like I just couldn't believe it, man, that he would be game to do that, because I've been reading his comics for like 30 years, maybe a little less. But like, yeah. And so then what happened was, at that point it was like he was game to do a cover. We figured it all out and everything, and he's gonna have Mike Spicer call. He's like, would you mind me bringing in my colorist, Mike Spicer? And I was like, oh no, yeah, that'd be cool with me, like, because I love Mike Spicer. Like, I think his coloring is great, you know? And he immediately picked the Werewolf Priest story. Like, he just instantly picked it. And that was it. Like, I mean, he came back with the cover in like 5 days or something ridiculous like that. I absolutely loved it. And it's like full of these cool little details. Like, they're like the so the cover concept, if you haven't seen it, is a werewolf priest bursting into a confessional as a woman clutching a rosary, like, screams in horror. And if you look at the watch, it's like set to midnight, which was a really fun touch, I thought. And then like all the little splinters that kind of like fly up in the air as the werewolf erupts in there are all shaped like crucifixes, which is another must have taken him forever, but it looks amazing.
So then we've got, and I'm not going in any sort of order here. We're going to jump around a little bit, but we have the Responsabilitin story where you're working with Mr. Pink Lemonade himself, Nick Cagnetti. Talked a little bit about how you had connected with Nick and you're friendly with him, but you know, something that I wanted to point out in reading that story and having read Pink Lemonade, a thing I love about his work is that he is able to acknowledge the darker, cynical side of comics while not being cynical himself and sort of still celebrating it as this joyful pop art medium. And I've, you know, that definitely comes through here. How was the experience of kind of, you know, working with him?
I mean, I don't think I could have done that story without him, to be honest with you. Like, I don't think it works in the same way because, like, yeah, like exactly as you described it, that's such a perfect summation of his work and what he brings to comics. And it's also like he's really a very clever artist. Like the way he puts details in things and kind of just the storytelling that he brings to movement through the panels, like it is an incredibly smart storyteller. So yeah, like I had known him because I interviewed him for Comics Beat, and then I said hi to him at like we hung out a little bit over the summer at Heroes Con and later at San Diego. I think we were already working on the story at that point. But I basically wrote. I was trying to do once I just had the idea to do this anthology. I had a horror story and I had a fantasy story, and I was trying to do a superhero. Because I've always liked superheroes and I wanted to like try my hand at it. I was trying and like sort of miserably failing. And like it just felt like every idea I was trying to bring to it just felt so tired and like I was just regurgitating my favorite stuff. And then so like and at the same time I've been thinking a lot about Pink Lemonade and how that was kind of a small part of what was for sale with it, like the way he brought back some of the 90s stuff. Like I think the character's name was Ron Radical. This is like a lot. I felt like a Liefeld riff. And so and it got me to, and I knew he really liked Spider-Man. And so that the Spider-Man riff in there started to take shape. But yeah, like, so I just wrote it kind of to his, it was a mix of my like love of superheroes, but the like frustration of how hard it is to do anything original in that genre and sort of like what you described as Nick's like ability to tackle some of the most cynical parts of comics without losing the love and joy for it. And that's really what shaped that story. Also, like, it's a kind of a satire of this like unbridled excitement that's kind of coming from the C-suite for AI in like every like sector. Like, I don't know any like salary, like normal salaried worker who's like, I'm super excited about this. Like, it's all from like executives. Like, you know, so that was kind of like, this idea that there's this technology that like a very powerful small part of the world's excited about, but as a real human who has to like work through things, it's pretty terrifying. There's a lot going
And
on in that one.
yes, there is, including my favorite detail in the story, apart from the larger themes, obviously. Whose idea was it to have a character in the story wear a shirt with the cool S on it?
That was all Nick. Like I had like yeah, like I had like group of modern day teens or something. Like Nick gave him the ass. Like I think the only thing I added was maybe one of them is vaping and another is like filming with their phone. And yeah, but yeah, Nick did the old ass that we all doodled on our loose leaf for throughout our school careers. Like yeah, that was all him. I can't take any credit for that. But I was glad to see it when it came. The pencils came back.
That S is timeless.
Yeah, no, yeah. I don't even know what it means or where it came from or anything about it. I've drawn it like I could draw one right now from memory, but I have no idea what the if there's any symbolism behind that S, what where it came from, what it is.
Nick did the variant cover too for this book, right?
Yeah, he did the so there's three covers. There's the McRae one, Nick did the special superhero variant where he like drew his own logo for it. The normal logo is designed by John J. Hill. It's super cool. And then third one, which we'll be unveiling this week, it's Raoul Allen's finishing it up. It should be pretty cool. It probably by the time this is anyone's listening to this, it'll be out there. But
Nice, nice,
yeah, Nick
nice.
did the variant. the Responsibility Teen first appearance variant, very rare, destined to be a collector's item. Only available first printing on this Kickstarter. Key issue, all of it.
You're welcome, speculators.
Yeah. Put it on those apps you guys have. Isn't there a key issue app that people use? I don't know.
Probably. I don't know what it is.
I think there is. I because there's this guy at a comic shop I used to go to who would have the like maybe it's a website, maybe the key issue website. Be like, this is a key. This is a key. I'm looking for a key. Yeah. Process comics very differently.
What's that? What's that line in Ghostbusters? If someone asks you if you're the key master, just say yes. Oh boy. So next, again, not going in order. You got PJ Holden to draw a bunch of apes and sharks.
Sure did. Yeah. PJ's drawn quite a like I associate him as one of the best ape artists of our time. I don't know if that's going out on a limb, but he's drawn quite a few apes for 2000 AD. I this last year I've like really gotten into reading the prog every week. Like it's I just started to really love, I guess it was because I was working on short comics maybe, and they kind of use the anthology 6 pages at a time format. So I've been meaning to get it into it for a long time. But he was like I'd seen some of his stuff in a I want to say it was like a best. Maybe it wasn't best of 2000 AD. It was some collection of 2000 AD where he'd drawn apes. And so I was writing this because I didn't want to make a 48-page comic that did not have apes in it, obviously. And I was writing it, and I kind of threw out, I started to wonder, like, you hear that there's these things that artists absolutely hate drawing, and, except for Pat Scott, like, I was going to be working with a slate of totally new collaborators, so I didn't really want to put anyone through something totally miserable. So I just threw it out in Blue Sky, like, "Hey, is drawing apes in, is like horses or cars or something? Do artists hate it?" And PJ like responded, like, "No, drawing apes is great. It's just the same thing as drawing people, but they're apes." And so that like I remembered that. And then as I was finishing up the short, I was like, "Why not just ask him?" Like, he and I think he'd put something like, "Hey, after next month, like I'll have an opening, maybe." Like a lot of what a lot of the creators that ended up on the book were people who had like publicly noted that they had availability. And PJ was one of those. And I set up the script, and he was like, "Yeah, I'll have time later this month." And he actually like knocked out all 7 pages in like 11 days, maybe. He was like sending me pages in real time, like page 8 done, page 6 done, whatever. Like it was pretty impressive. Took me way longer to write that silly thing.
Well, it is a meditation on grief.
That as funny as it sounds, like the ape shark story is like the most personal thing in the book. So it was really, but working with him, I mean, I feel like he's a super underrated artist. Like he's done that battle action stuff. Like it's just because he's done a lot of UK stuff, but he started to do more DC work lately. And so I'm hoping like more people check out his stuff because he's like an incredible cartoonist, war comics, apes, all the good stuff. He can do it.
You said you kind of started this process with the fantasy pitch and the horror pitch already in your pocket. The fantasy pitch is Gold Mask with Luke Horsman.
So the Gold Mask, it's so like the difference between the horror pitch is like the first 8 pages of a new number one, essentially. But the Gold Mask story is more of a proof of concept. It's like this is the character, this is his voice, this is his like begrudging moral compass that he has. Like those are the three things we were trying to show off with that, were the character design, the voice, and the moral compass. And that was one I'd worked on. I'd been like toying with that character, this like idea of a dark mage who wears this big gold mask and is kind of a smart ass for like, I don't know, man, forever. Like it was one of the first concepts I came up with when I was trying to write comics was this gold mask character. And it was another thing a little bit similar to the Responsibility Teen where I was like, fantasy is a really hard thing to do in 8 pages. Like most fantasy first novels are hundreds of pages with maps. Like, so I'm trying to do it like an 8-page comic. And so part of it, what happened was like the voice I had, the smart alecky voice, kind of turned against the idea of a fantasy comic at a certain point and just started like making jokes about like, oh, this dark wizardry, like not the same as it used to be or whatever. But yeah, that, and Luke Horsman, to kind of get back to the original premise, like I met the artist, is another 2000 AD artist. He just did this thing with Kevin Scott called Enemy Earth that wrapped up recently in the Prague. And I just love his character designs. Like there's a little bit of like almost Phil Hester kind of energy to them, to a point. And yeah, like Gold Mask has a magic mask that contorts so that you can like see his facial expressions. And I just think it's Luke's design on it is adorable and hilarious and like made a bunch of the jokes land so much better than they ever would have without those visuals. And I was really excited to have Jason Wordy color it because he's one of my favorite colorists. I think he brings a lot to fantasy in particular. Like what he's coloring the Wes Craig book, Kaya, I think he would, I don't know how to pronounce it, Kaya, Kaya. Yeah, and the colors are just unbelievable. Jason's so good. Yeah, I was really pleased with, I was like, man, they really made me look good with this one. Like, because the acting on the little gold mask face is just such a riot.
Have you ever played D&D? I'm just curious.
So yeah, great question. Gold Mask is also a D&D character I played years ago. Like that's where the impetus came from when I started toying with him as a comic concept was I would tell you all about the campaign if you want, but it was like an evil guy campaign. And I really like playing evil characters. So my like evil guy ended up having this begrudging moral compass where he was like kind of trying to do the right thing, but also gr letting you know about it aggressively and just grumbling the whole time, which is also something I personally relate to on a very deep level. Like whenever I do the right thing, like everyone around me is going to hear about it, like to the point where they're like, God, just go away, you know?
Of an evil guy campaign, or the campaign where you're the evil guy, even if you're amongst mostly neutral characters, can be a ton of fun. I recently, well, it didn't end well for him, but was a half a dragonborn serial killer in a campaign, like
Nice.
Fantasy Dexter. Like he had this like strict, you only kill crappy people, and literally had like a demon in his, a devil in his head, talking to him and telling him, you need to kill, you need to kill.
Was he a warlock?
I was he was a rogue who had been possessed as a child, and I was lean if he had lived longer, he would have multi-classed into
Yeah.
warlock eventually, but he got really irritated with the party's inability to focus, and so wound up, they said, betraying them. He really was sort of trying to get them to the end goal, and if that involved seemingly selling them out to the big bad while secretly planning to kill him while he was attacking them, it made sense to him at the time. Only they caught wind of it first and kind of murdered him.
Oof. Was that annoyance at getting off track? Was that a very personal quality that you assigned to the character?
Maybe I'm the one, the player who tries to keep the group on task while everyone else goes, ooh, shiny side quest.
Sure.
That
What
might be me.
was the tip, if I could ask, for what made you think a gold mask might be a D&D character?
I wasn't sure if he was a D&D character, but I've found that people who, writers who play at these sort of, let me tweak the nose of the fantasy tropes in a kind of wildly comedic, like a character who is frustrated with those tropes, often have an experience as D&D players because they've all been through a campaign
Yeah.
or two where there's a ton of those tropes, and you're just kind of like, can we just get on with it and, you know, do something that isn't marching through the fields with a bunch of elves talking about how great they are?
Right. I was also reading Terry Pratchett at the time as when I started writing it. That was the other that was other big influence when it came time to like kind of really get into it.
The bookcase reminds me of the luggage.
Yeah, maybe that. I never made that connection. I would always think of it in terms of like how Pratchett influenced the Gold Mask story. But yeah, maybe that the luggage was, because I was reading the Rincewind books actually as I was writing this. Like all last summer, I was reading the Rincewind books.
That stuff.
Yeah, it's the best.
And onto the other of those stories that you had, you know, a lead on, Anna Redman and Werewolf Priest.
Yeah, so that, yeah, the Werewolf Priest one, it's about a kid who gets a job as a reporter at a dying newspaper in South Texas right out of college, which is a thing I actually did. Like when I graduated, I went to journalism school and was like really into it. Like, I don't know, Dan, did you go to journal? I know you work at a newspaper. Did you go to journalism school and stuff?
I did. I got my master's from Temple in 06.
Oh yeah. So were you really like into it too at the, like, were you like, I was really into journalism for a long, long time. Like,
okay. So I think I wanted to be like, when I was still in college, I think I wanted to be like an entertainment reporter. I think I wanted to like write for Rolling Stone, that kind of a thing. And then I realized, okay, well, I'm in South Jersey. and I need a job. So maybe I'll go get my master's.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I kind of felt like I had this idea that like you could like go to journalism school, get a job at a newspaper and like really change things, you know, and like really, and so I was super into it. Like I had like a journalism fellowship the summer I graduated and like got to meet all these like sort of highfalutin journalists and stuff. And I took this job in McAllen, Texas, which is like 3.5 hours south of San Antonio. Most people don't realize that that's still the United States. Like it's right down in the corner, like by Brownsville and where SpaceX and all that stuff is launching from now. So I was there for like 4.5 5 years working at this newspaper, the McAllen Monitor, which was like going like the company that owned them, as a lot of newspapers were like post recession, was like going through bankruptcy. So like we had this like newspaper that like really the community had sort of stopped reading, and at the same time we were trying to cover like border patrol and like smuggling and police chases and all this like really heavy stuff. And I was like 23 working like from 2:30 p.m. to like midnight a lot of Tuesday through Saturday, driving around the Rio Grande Valley, like the border with Mexico, covering this like really difficult stuff. And while I was there, like I eventually got moved on to the features desk, like because I wanted to work normal human hours, like stop the night stuff. And I wrote this feature story about this priest down there who was like went around collecting dogs, like adopting dogs into his rectory. He had something like 12, 13, 14 dogs. I followed him around for a week while he's trying to adopt this dog that was like really kind of skittish and was like living in this old shed. It always stuck with me. Like I thought it was a really interesting story. The dogs would follow this priest everywhere. Like he would go to say mass and like some of the older dogs would like fall asleep on the altar. And like the kids would come up and pet him and stuff. Like I just thought he was an interesting guy. And so I wanted to write a horror story. And I was like, what if I turn that guy or like a very loose impression of him into a werewolf? That would really be something. And so like that's how that one came to be. And then I just put a bit of a self insert with like, I was trying to write originally with like the werewolf priest was going to be like the main guy, but like, I don't know anything about being a priest. Like, what do I know about being a priest? So like, I wanted a lens that was like a little easier to relate to than a priest who'd been turned into a werewolf. So that's how the like, fresh out of school, very, and I like really leaned into the naivety that I felt like going down there, like I'm going to be this hotshot journalist. I've never been to Texas. I take this job and I'm just like totally outmatched. I mean, it felt like a horror movie, to be honest, like a little bit that time. I didn't have a friend for like hundreds of miles, you know, like I was nowhere. Yeah. And so then I Anna Redman had drawn the variant cover for Next Door, which was like this, like Next Door is a neighborhood crime comic. And the variant she drew was like a real estate sign that was like kind of broken and leaning with like a ton of weapons that's sticking out of it, like 30 weapons, like pickaxes and like machetes and all these bullet holes and stuff. And a dog urinating on the sign, just like with this hilarious look on his face. I was like, my God, like in this one cover, there's so much storytelling and it's so entertaining. And like, also there's a dog. Why don't I ask her if she wants to collaborate on this werewolf priest idea I had? And she was like super game. She was like, oh yeah, pulpy Texas horror with a werewolf priest. Brilliant. Let's do it. Like, and she brought so much to it. Like there's this page of a like squalid sort of empty newsroom where everything's outdated and there's like a rat running around that that's like, I want to buy that page from her and hang it in my office. Like my wife's a journalist as well, so it'd be kind of fun to have around here. But like, yeah, like she just brought a lot of details to it, and jokes, and just like, I can't say enough good things. And like, man, I would love to turn, like, I have an idea like that. I just want to write that as like a mini series into a full first issue. Like, I would love to kind of expand upon that. And I've tried to talk to publishers here and there, but it's tough, you know. So hopefully there'll be more of that to come at some point.
As a lover of cheesy B horror movies, I do have to ask, and you might not be completely unaware of what I'm about to ask, and I would respect that, as you would mean you would not have wasted 80 minutes of your life on this. But who wins in a fight, werewolf priest or Velocipastor?
Velocipastor. Oh man. No, so I'm not aware of that, but like I feel like, you know, like the context clues are enough for me to figure out what it's a dinosaur priest, right? Like is
It's he's he turns into a were dinosaur.
a were dinosaur. Wow, that's
But he's wearing one of those like inf it is a the B-est of B movies. Like he's wearing one of those like inflatable T-Rex costumes that they have people standing outside store openings dancing to attract attention. It's an awful movie.
I'm curious. You've piqued my interest, but I think Werewolf Priest would win because the inflatable costume would pop rapidly and just expose the human inside.
Perfect answer. There we go. Those 8 pages are more of a horror story than 80 plus minutes of Velocipastor.
Well, thank you. Yeah, take that, Velocipastor, catching strays.
You could add that to the list of blurbs.
Yeah, I will. I will. I actually will. I'm gonna put that on the campaign page.
I will sign off on that.
I am actually going to do this. Well, I don't know. I don't want to upset the Velocipastor people. You don't know who they know.
Think you're good.
Oh no, I've been blackballed from working with Tubi.
You never know, man. You never know. They could have powerful friends, Velocipastor people.
That's fair. That's fair. Someone's dad totally owns a dealership.
The guy who made its dad is in the movie. That's what happened.
Oh, so Pat Scott, you guys already worked together on Next Door. What made you want to tell another story in that world?
I really was proud of Next Door for what it was. Like I said at the beginning, like it was kind of, it's very subtle, and it was born out of trying to like make a comic about everyday things, which is maybe not always the best or most marketable idea to take to Kickstarter, where people make comics about ninja nuns and stuff or whatever they have. I don't know what they, you know, it's like flashy ideas do better on there, and we took our like everyday book on there. So I was always proud of it, and I wanted to like do more of it eventually, because I like the character who kind of shows up at the end, who's a bit of an antagonist, was always interesting to me, and he's kind of the star of this follow-up. And when we'd done that, I was reading a lot of Stray Bullets by David Lapham, and like if you've read Stray Bullets, like he never has a lazy bad guy. Like every threat to the protagonist has their own deal and is super interesting. And like, and so that's what I try to emulate with this character. And I'd really liked how it turned out, and I wanted to do more with him. And like, the thing with Next Door, I think, is it's sort of about when how bad things happen when you don't communicate and don't necessarily understand your neighbors. And so combining him with teens, as we talked about earlier, who I don't understand, was a natural next step for that character. Like, and there's like TikTok shows up as sort of like, I don't know if this story is like, not to give away the like conceit of it entirely, but I guess the big bad might be TikTok for this guy. I don't know. It's like a misunderstanding between him and some kids. And it just felt like Next Door is kind of a dark ending written during the pandemic summer. And so this one felt like giving this guy a little bit of letting the air out of what had happened to him at the end of the first comic, which you can find on Gumroad and Global Comics if you're interested. You can read it on Global Comics for free. Like, I think it's $1 to download the PDF, but if you just want to look through it, I welcome you to. I invite you to. Please do. It's on Global Comics.
Speaking of Next Door, speaking of that first campaign, what would you say is sort of the biggest lesson from that Kickstarter that you took into this one?
Take longer to prepare than you think you're going to need. Hands down. I remember like I started to have pieces of this book done. Like the whole book is done. Like you guys have seen it. And that costs more. And it took me like it's been 3 years since the Next Door came out. So it took longer to do in order to like sort of save the money, get the artist I wanted, and produce the book out of pocket. But like having all of that time to think about how you're going to like present this on Kickstarter, and then also like having the art assets, and just like it's just so invaluable. Like a weird thing to me about Kickstarter it and about my first Kickstarter was I came on this show and I was like, this is going to be great, support it, but I didn't know it wasn't done. Like it wasn't a thing that existed, and you kind of have to do that with the model a little bit. I didn't want to do that again. Like I wanted to like really have it online. And so yeah, that was the big lesson. Like take longer, be more deliberate. If you have the privilege of being able to use it as sort of a pre-order system instead of like we need your money to make a thing, do that. Like I think it's like it's just a better way to present comics and to have something ready to both market the campaign and get to people while they're still excited. Because I think for a lot of Kickstarters, like excitement for the actual things peaks like towards the end of the campaign, like maybe right at the end, like people are like, yeah, we did it, it funded, like, and then they wait a year and a half. It's like I get Kickstarters in the mail, it's nobody's fault, but I don't even remember them like pretty regularly. Like I'll have a big stack and be like, I don't know, this looks cool, I'll read it, but I don't remember like why I was excited about it, you know. So I was trying to like this thing will end May 2nd. If we fund, like the PDF will go out within a week. Like we're just the designer needs to put the thank yous in the book. That's all that needs to be done for the PDF. And then as soon as that's done, it goes right to the printer. And as soon as I can get it back and packed into a million Gemini mailer, well, not a million, I'm not gonna be that optimistic, but like hopefully 100 to 400 Gemini mailers, like then it'll get out to people. So yeah, that was the big lesson. Like prepare, prepare, prepare. If your idea is half cooked, I think it shows. And like, no matter what kind of brilliant promoter you are, like, I think some people will be able to tell and not support it. And even if they do, maybe they won't read it when it comes eventually. So like, yeah, that was my thinking with my lessons learned with this one. Take the day off work when you launch. I'm taking a vacation day for this launch.
The number of times that I've gotten the, message through a comic that I backed that issue two is now on Kickstarter. I'm like, I don't think I've read issue one. I should probably do that to decide if I want to back issue two.
No, I know. It's kind of just an effect of the model, you know, like just the timeline it takes, like from when a campaign ends to when you get it. Like it's tough. It's tough to, and then you'll get these like I feel like you get a lot of cryptic updates like 9 months after you back something, like work is progressing, and that's usually like the writer doesn't know what's going on. Like they're just waiting on colors or whatever, you know. Like yeah, I just wanted to avoid that whole scene. Like, and I understand why people have to do it, but like that's why I took 3 years to kind of do this more deliberately than last time. I didn't want to go through it again.
So we've mentioned all the artists, but there's also still, whole teams of, you're working with full creative teams of colorists and letters and whatnot. Did you have to pitch each one of these, folks by yourself to jump on board? Or, like in the case of John McCrae bringing in Mike Spicer, the artist kind of helped with, the rest of the team.
Every one of the color decisions was sort of made in consultation with the artists. Like, we talked about it. I think I was a little more, I think with a couple of them, like Brad Simpson and Jason Wordy were a pair of colorists I'd like my two of my favorite colorists that I like really wanted to work for. So like I think I put my finger on the scale a little bit with that as I was sort of presenting it to Anna and Luke, like, hey, you know who would be good for this one? Like that kind of thing with them. Yeah, but they all had to be to maximize the stress and coordination. They all had to be brought in sort of with emails pitched with like, here's some of the work we've already done. Here's what you would be joining. Here's the script. Do you have time? When do you have time? Like there was a lot of scheduling and waiting on schedules to get like that was another luxury of sort of taking time to do this was like if there was somebody you really wanted to work with and you could give them a longer timeline. I think that was beneficial. Like, I think the three things, the way I thought of it, like the three things you really need to bring in the collaborators you really want to work with are like one, a good script, because you're nobody. Like, I know, like I've heard like Brian Bendis talk about like, yeah, like I don't do the scripts until I have my collaborator and we work it out together. But like, I'm not Brian Bendis. Like, nobody's gonna be like, trust me to like dedicate this time. And let, so like, I try to add the script in order and put in my homework to make to like guess if it's going to be something they want to draw, and then two, offer a page rate, and three, offer a flexible timeline. It's just 8 pages, but like, yeah, like if somebody can't fit me until later the year but likes the script, I'm willing to wait, you know? So those were the that's how I think that was like the guiding philosophy to bringing in. I mean, even the letterers to an extent. Like we had Simon Bolin letter. The PJ Holden story. That took a little waiting on his schedule, but I really thought it would look cool if he did that because he's lettered a lot of 2000 AD and just great letterer, you know? Yeah. I feel like there's a little bit of art to it, to like enticing collaborators. Like I was really happy. Like every one of the artists on this was the first choice. There was nobody who said no to the initial pitch.
Were any of these stories more challenging than the others in any aspect?
Yeah, the two hardest ones were Responsibilitine and Apes versus Sharks were both like harder for me to write than the others. Like Next Door was the easiest by far because the world was already created from a 30-page one shot. Every one of the other ones, it was like having to develop, like having to bring people into a new world and also try to deliver something satisfying within the space of 8 pages is like, man, a headache. Like, every time it's a heavy lift, but both Responsibilitine and Apes versus Sharks, I think because they were such like well-tread like superheroes and sci-fi war are kind of pretty well-tread comics areas, so it's like really took a lot to find ways to like make it satisfying for me to be like, all right, I think I did something a little bit different with these. And Apes versus Sharks, like we talked about, had like some really personal stuff in it, and so I was like really precious with like how that one turned out and took like for like I think I started writing it at San Diego Comic-Con and everything else was written, and I don't think I reached out to PJ until November, so that was like 3 months to write 7 pages or something. I was just like trying things and figuring out what I wanted to say and all this stuff. Like that was yeah. So yeah, I guess that one was the hardest, and then second would be Responsibilitine, just because like we were saying, there's a lot going on in that one. It gets kind of a little dense.
And in addition to all these, great folks working on the book, you've also got blurbs from additional, friends and folks in the industry. How is the process of going hat in hand to these people and being like, you want to put some nice words on this thing I made?
Here's a secret. Like when you're writing for Comics Beat, they have come hat in hand to you at some point, more than likely, to ask you to interview them or to do a little thing for whatever they're working on. So like a couple of them had, it was like, I won't name any names, but some had come to me like, hey, can you, will you interview me? I did, and then immediately it was like, "Hey, will you check out my thing and see if you like it?" Like as coming back, so it was a little friendly, like, "Hey, you read my thing, I'll read yours," kind of thing. But a lot of them are also people I've known. I mean, I started Comics Bookcase in 2018, early 2018, like January 2018 is when I really got into it. So like Wasted Space that Michael Morisi wrote was the first comic I ever reviewed for that web for my blog. So I've known him, and it wasn't like he'll tell you, he'll joke about it. Like it wasn't that well read. Like it wasn't Barbaric's been a smash hit, but like Wasted Space had a small but very local, very loyal audience, and I was like a big vocal supporter of that. So we've kind of been like pals for a little while. I mean, like cordial comics buds for a little while, you know. So like yeah, and and some of them I tried to pair to like Michael Morisi I had sent the fantasy story to, or Chris Condon I sent the Texas horror story to, like hey, I think you might like this, like if you like it, will you send a little blurb? But that's the fun part, like sharing it when it's done is really like a lot more fun than like it doesn't feel like you're really nervous about asking somebody for a blurb, like because if I was, I probably wouldn't ask that person, you know. I usually have a level of comfort with whoever I'm approaching that. Although I did, like, I probably shouldn't tell this story, but I will. That's like podcast gold, right? Like, I had interviewed Brian K. Vaughan, and I was like, I'm gonna shoot my shot. I'm gonna send this thing to Brian K. Vaughan, get a shiny Brian K. Vaughan blurb on it. And it's like, and Brian K. Vaughan's nicest guy in the world, and he's like, hey, my to read list is just out of control, but like I'll put the link in my newsletter. And like I'd written a thing about Saga getting a new smaller printing, and he put in parentheses like, and Zach has his own comic coming out, end parentheses. I was like, all right, like that is the nicest thing, like thank you so much. But it was probably a little like so that was like the one person I reached out to who I'd maybe interacted with twice to ask, but like he's one of my favorite creators, and I was really proud of this thing, so I figured I'm gonna try it. But very nice of him to do that. I kind of overbilled that when I called it podcast gold, by the way.
So let's say all the characters from these stories, Responsibility, Stone, Werewolf Priest, Gold Mask, etc., they get together for a party. Which of them is intentionally going to play the nastiest game of cards against humanity?
That might be the most interesting question I've been asked about this book. Either Gold Mask or Stone, I think would be the nastiest cards against humanity player. Stone has a history of exaggerating everything and is very loud about it. And Gold Mask has, I mean, who knows what he knows about the occult? Like, you don't know. Like, he's probably seen some things. I think the Werewolf Priest would prefer apples to Cards Against Humanity. He's like a man of God.
And responsibility would have to then go and clean highways for a while to get his powers back, I guess.
Yeah, he'd have to like agree to like, because all the responsibilities he takes on so far have been relatively minor, so he'd have to agree to like take the salmon out so it could rest 30 minutes before you cook it. You're supposed to do a salmon.
I was going to say he just stays and helps you clean up the party.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, that's better. That's less complicated. There you go. Yeah, and then he gains whatever new power.
So, what's something you feel like you learned about yourself as a comics creator through this process?
Yeah, I think I learned, I mean, I always knew that I liked to that the part of the reason I like comics was I thought it afforded you a little bit more license to be madcap, I guess, with your ideas. Or like I had spent after and during when I was a newspaper reporter, I had written literary short stories. Like I was reading like Jonathan Franzen and like Alice Munro and like all these like really serious writers who write it. Like a lot of times those stories are like nothing happened and the protagonist is very sad, you know. And so I'd written a lot of stories like that, and these stories are not that at all. Like I guess I learned that what had drawn me to comics as a medium, as compared to working in prose or something was that it afforded you a license to be a little loonier. John Lee said, who read the book, had my favorite. One of my favorite blurbs about it, where he said, like, Quaintance and his collaborators maintain an enjoyable tone of inspired lunacy. And I was like, man, if that doesn't just nail it, like, inspired lunacy is like, if that's the takeaway everyone has, I'll be so thrilled. And that's what I feel like I learned about myself, like, that my preferred tone as a creative is a little madcap, a little loony, a little, I guess. I mean, I didn't think of it as unhinged until I started showing it to people. People were like, whoa, this is wacky. I was like, oh, thanks. Like, I guess I was trying to make myself laugh here and there, but yeah. And I also feel like I didn't sacrifice the, like, the deeper stuff to it. Like, I think that there is a little, like, the inspired lunacy is dead on, but, like, Werewolf Priest is about this traumatic time in my life, and, like, Responsibility is about a fear of AI encroaching. And so I think it's like that I learned that I could balance the impulse to write about more serious things that I had when I was younger with this sort of impulse to play in a medium that affords you a little bit more goofiness. As I've gotten older, that's been something I've, like, wanted to, I felt is a little more freeing as a creative than being hemmed in to, like, more grounded stuff.
Now, Death of Comics Bookcase Volume 1 implies a Volume 2. Where are we on the scale of optimistic manifesting to it's definitely going to happen?
I mean, I've got the stories lined up that I want to do for that one. It really depends entirely on how well this Kickstarter does. Like, if the Kickstarter does well enough, it will happen, and it will happen quickly. Like, I can go right into getting these things made if the Kickstarter does well. Like, every dime I make past what it takes to print it is going right into making a sequel, more or less. And Matt, you'll like this, I think. If there is a sequel, the sequel to Death of Comics Bookcase will, of course, be Reign of the Comics Bookcases. And we may do a trilogy where Return of Comics Bookcase would be the capper on it. So, like, I would love to do the second one. Not to spoil it, but you could tell from the title, the framing sequence would involve, of course, Cyborg bookcase, bookcase of steel, et cetera, et cetera. But yeah, like, it in my mind, I'm determined to do a second volume. It's like, it's just if the Kickstarter does well enough, it will determine how quickly it comes to pass.
I would read that book.
I think you like it. Yeah, I know you're DC, big DC guy. So. I love Death, the progression of Death, Reign, Return, like, it's good memories associated with all that.
So, our grand Twitter inquisitor, Asimov Fangirl, wrote in to ask, kind of off topic, but I would like to ask everyone, how many IRL comic bookcases do you have? And how do you organize the comics or trades on them? Editorial, genre, size, etc.
I'll let you guys go first. I feel like we could do a whole podcast. I would do a whole podcast about this, but I'm anxious to hear what you guys say.
Okay, so in the bedroom, I have a bookcase. It's mostly that's where I keep like my Omnibuy, my Essentials, my Epic collections, the thick and fancies. And then down in the basement, most of my comics are actually in a filing cabinet. But then there's like a another bunch spilling out into like various short boxes. Or now I've got one of those those things you buy at Target that are like the sort of cube frames, and then you get like the fabric bins to put them in. Well, I just have the
Yeah.
cube. I don't have the bins. I have the cube though, or the cubes. And then I have them starting to like line up on that now. So there's probably a better way to do it, but I'm too lazy to file. So there's that.
Now, as I'm a fangirl, you listen to both of my podcasts, so you have heard me talk for years about how when we bought this house, my whole goal was to have that garage insulated and drywalled and set up with big racks for long boxes and bookcases. And it's been 10 years and I'm still not there. So right now I've got one big Billy bookcase and three small Billy bookcases. The big one is full of the unread stuff, and then it kind of moves into the small ones until I reach a kind of critical mass where I don't have any more room. Then I just take some diamond boxes from my local comic shop and I just put some stuff in them. So I have many, many diamond boxes waiting to be put on fuller bookcases when the garage is finally ready. It's a labor. And I want to have to be able to display everything. My plan would be to display them by sort of genre company kind of thing, like a bookcase for all the Vertigo stuff, a bookcase for DC, a bookcase for Marvel, a bookcase for Image, and with specifically all of my volumes of the one manga I've read religiously case closed that has a continuing little image along the binding that if you follow it along, you'll see them all running across the top. So you can see the little progression of the character. But you know, I will take photos when I am finally there. It will happen someday. Every homeowner has that project that they swear they're going to get done and they never do. And the garage of comics library is mine.
I've always had this, like, I don't want to say a fantasy of like moving to the suburbs, like and having a comics garage or basement. Like that was always my eventual plan, was like to do something very elaborate in a garage or basement in some place where like space was available. But like I was just stacking up single issue after single issue in my small city condo. Something had to give after a while. So I've kind of like I have all my most prized single issues in these like hard plastic boxes and in against a wall in my closet, like, and there's shoes like kept on top of them. But what I've really like invested my energy into is an actual like comics bookcase that I have in my office here, that is like Matt's a work in progress. But like, yeah, I've got, this is all IKEA stuff. Those four sectioned, like four little boxes stacked on top of also four little boxes, but these have little doors on them, so it's like a whole wall. Maybe 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 pieces of furniture from IKEA, all filled with books, and all the really unorganized stuff is on the bottom layer, which is the pieces that have doors on them, so you can't see the chaos. And then I've done a little bit better with the stuff above. And I've got like I do have it by section. Like I have a manga section with like Pluto and Akira, and then I have past that stuff organized by publisher. Like I have Vertigo, Vault, Image, and then a cool small section with all those little first, second sized paperbacks. I'm pretty proud of it. And I recently just got two new shelves mounted on the wall above my computer, where I'm doing like a wall of favorites. And up there I have the new Astro City Metro books, the new Powers paperbacks from Dark Horse that they're putting out, which are pretty slick, the Essential Judge Dreads, and then like a grab bag of my favorite recent trades. It's got stuff like 20th Century Men, Mountain Heads up there, Superman's pal Jimmy Olsen. So happy to share pictures, and at literally any time, I will stop what I'm doing, come down here and take a bunch of pictures of my comic shelves.
Is that monster right above Akira?
That is Monster. Yeah, I love the Urasawa stuff. Pluto, Monster. I don't have 20th Century Boys yet, but that'll come up here eventually.
Because those are a very distinct binding, and I have the same editions. So.
Oh yeah. And it's funny, like this shows up, like these shelves are like to my left, like like a person hovering beside me, and it shows up in my work Zoom calls. So like if you ever have to deal with me on a professional basis, you open up the Zoom cam, it's like bam, there's Akira, like right sitting right next to me. every once in a while somebody will be like, is that manga? And I'll be like, yeah. And then the conversation sort of dies there. Like if we go into whatever we have to talk about for work.
So we're coming up to the end here, so we'll ask the most important question. How's your dog?
Oh, he is ornery as it gets. You have a dachshund as well, don't you? Or like a,
I have two, yes.
yeah. Are your like? I feel like they come in two types. There's like the mine is definitely the like ornery Napoleon complex brand of dachshund, who like wants to fight the world, but he loves us. He, I mean, and as far as how he's doing, he's living the good life. Like this dog wants for nothing. Although we are locked in a battle for perpetual dominance. Like he's always trying to pull one over. Like he knows how to sit, but he'll like sometimes just to test me, he'll crouch a little. Like he won't sit all the way butt to the ground. And I'll have to be like, what are we doing here? Like you gotta sit. You're not getting the treat till you the butt hits the ground. So yeah, he's always trying to like take over as pack leader, destroy the neighbors and scare off children. Your dachshunds look nicer, to be honest with you.
Well, lately they've been on our shit list. The dogs have become nocturnal.
Oh no, that's a nightmare
Yeah.
scenario.
And the see, part of the problem is Chewy, our oldest, is 14,
Oh,
right?
okay.
So she's, get up there in years, and I think part of it is she knows that we'll cave to her. So there's a couple of times a night where she just starts scratching at the door, and it's like, well, she might have to go to the bathroom, and I don't want to have to clean that shit up. So I guess I better get up and let her out. I say I honestly, unfortunately, my wife is doing a lot of this, but half the time it's just she to drink a ton of water, and then less so to go out, but she will do that too, when pressed. So that's it's like having a baby right now, a human baby, except it's a geriatric dachshund.
Yeah, I grew up, we had dachshunds when I was growing up, and they would get to the one of them had like Cushing's, which is like basically thirsty pee disease, when you got to be 15. But I think every dachshund I've had, I don't know if yours do this, he does like if you get they're house trained, but if you get them mad enough, they do a protest pee, like they'll
Oh,
just, yeah, the protest pee,
I know the
like.
protest bee, unfortunately, all too well.
Yeah, I've never heard of any other breed of dog that has figured out, what really makes my owner mad? Peeing. Like I'm gonna do it. Like,
So they're just cats. Because that is a cat behavior if there ever is one.
Matt,
I never
honestly,
had a cat.
yes. Chewy has cat energy. She really does.
No, that there are cat behaviorists who say that the peeing outside the litter box is not anger or spite. It's they don't feel comfortable in the litter box because there's something wrong, and that is true too. But there are absolutely times where it is, oh, I don't f you didn't clean the litter box today. I'm going to pee right in front of it to point out that the litter box is not clean and you must clean it.
My college roommate had a cat that would, in the middle of the night, like if I got up to use the restroom and didn't close my door, would run into my room and pee on my bed, like clockwork. Anytime I got up and we'd get a glass of water or something, this cat would run in and urinate on my bed and run out. Like, yeah, I think once they pee somewhere one time, they like to pee there again was part of it. But what a horrible, horrible reality to live under in college. Like,
Oh yeah.
you
Yeah.
don't have easy access to a washing machine.
Right. Like
Yeah,
there aren't
you.
enough pranks going around in college.
Yeah. Now the cat's pranking me. Come on.
No, that's absolutely true. If they pee on the carpet, you have to really clean it because otherwise it becomes a spot they return to.
They have
Like
marked
clean
their
it
territory.
hardcore.
Yeah, what I did was this was college, so I was sleeping on an inflatable mattress because I didn't want to buy a bed at that time. So I went to Walmart, bought another inflatable mattress, put the cat pee one in the box and returned it and got a full discount. There's some
That's college.
Walmart in rural Illinois right now that's being like, "Oh, I just heard that son of a bitch. Like, you were the cat pee return mattress guy." Sorry, Walmart in Carbondale, Illinois.
Oh man. What is a book by another creator that's got you excited right now?
Well, there's a Kickstarter. I feel like there's a lot. I should mention Kickstarter, right? Because if you're on there asking people for money, you should help others out, right? It's called Starcrossed. It's Fraser Campbell. He worked with Lucy Sullivan before on Indexed. That one looks really, really cool. And then The Unsleeping Eye, also on Kickstarter by Brian Level, is doing that one. Those are a couple of other crowdfunding books I'm really excited about. Past that, like if you want to do like a mainstream direct market one, Dark Spaces Dungeon by Scott Snyder and Hayden Sherman is like I'm a little claustrophobic, and man, that is the scariest thing I have seen or read in I don't know how long. Like, that book is just creeping me out month after month after month, and it's got a really well constructed sort of detective mystery going on. Yeah, that one, that's probably my favorite horror comic of the year so far. What about you all? What are you reading?
Well, I'll tell you what, in terms of Kickstarter, I just got in this weekend. I backed The Dead in the Dam by Sebastian Gerner's Goats Flying Press.
Yeah.
Let me tell you, I mean, it's an oversized book. It looks gorgeous. Unfortunately, my copy got delivered and sat on my stoop in the rain for like a day.
Oh no.
I know it sucks. Like the envelope that came in was completely drenched through the plastic sleeve that the book came in. Again, they packaged it well. Like let me be clear about saying that the Goats Flying Press did nothing wrong. But I had posted a picture and you can see, like, here's my copy. I'm holding it up, like the
Oh
cover's
yeah,
all
it's
warped and stuff.
water damage.
And and Sebastian was like, dude, I'll send you another copy. And I'm like, he didn't have to do that. It's not his fault that the book got drenched in the rain. So he said he's going to send out another copy this week. And that's just, I can't say enough good things about that. So that's awesome.
Yeah, and he I had a question when I was setting up my Kickstarter that I reached out to him about, and he was so generous with his time to send me a really helpful answer. So like, yeah, that was a great campaign. I backed that one as well.
I'll just throw anything by Rom V right now. I'm
Oh
reading it
God, yeah.
all, and every one of the books is different and is cool between detective and The One Hand and Rare Flavors and Dawn Runner, which just launched. All of these books are just so cool. And you combine it with, because I just read the second issue of The Six Fingers from Dan Waters this morning. And reading The One Hand and The Six Fingers together is just such a cool experience, seeing this one story from the two different perspectives. Highly recommend.
Yeah, that one hand six finger stuff, man, that's awesome. Loving that. I love how frequently they it's not they're like different series, but it's kind of like the House of X, Powers of X, where they were coming out like you appreciate that cadence of release where it keeps it fresh in your mind, especially when you read a lot of comics. It's nice to go back into the world so quickly. Yeah, that stuff's great.
What else are you reading right now? Prose, comics, what else has got you excited?
Well, I've been rereading Powers because I was buying those Dark Horse oversized paperbacks, and I feel like there's like chunks of Powers I never read for like because it went on for so long. Like I read the original Image stuff as a pretty young kid, and then I think I missed part of it when I was in college getting my cat pee bed experience
Returning Pete
going.
on
It
mattresses
wasn't.
to Walmart.
Yeah. Obviously, I was hard up. I didn't have money for comics if I was doing that. It's like. But yeah, I've been rereading that. Man, what a treat. Like, that's just such a perfectly crafted series of great characters and such an interesting take on superheroes. And I actually think that, like, you know how the Boys TV show, are you guys watch that at all? Like,
I haven't.
I've seen
it's
some, yeah.
I think it's great. It's very different from the comic, and I think it like it borrows some of the ideas. I think Powers had a little bit of influence on the way that TV show is crafted, or I see a little overlap. I mean, maybe when you're just doing an alternate superhero take, there's only so many ways to do it. But like, yeah, I'm just really impressed with the sort of the Bendis, Michael Avon Oeming, noir superhero epic, and it's just so amazing. Like, Oeming's such an underrated art. I love that kind of art style. I think like Ryan Lee, who did the bookcase framing sequence, is kind of like has a little bit of common there, and like Riley Rossmo, like those sort of artists. I love that really cartoony comic stuff, and like his work in Powers is just unbelievable. And I saw he's like doing a new book, like a sci-fi book for Mad Cave, and I'm like Deep Space or something like that. I'm just so excited for that. I just love his work. Yeah, and then I'm also reading the Essential Judge Dredd books, like Judge Dredd stories from the 80s and stuff that I've never read. So checking those out. I love those comics. And they those big Essential Judge Dredd, Essential Rogue Trooper books are very pretty. Like this new shelf I have, got to fill it up, you know. So get some of those on there.
Well, Zach, this has been a fantastic time. Final question is to release you back into the world. How can people follow you online and keep up with Death of Comics Bookcase and everything else you got going on?
Yeah, I'm promoting heavily on X, Twitter, whatever, as Comics Bookcase. I don't really use that for anything more than promotion at this point these days. If you want to know what I'm eating, what I'm listening to, what movies I'm watching on the weekend, Blue Sky is a much better venue for that. I'm on there as Zach Quaintance. You can find Comics Bookcase also on Instagram, and I'm on there as Zach Q23. So those are the four places to find me online. Comicsbookcase.com still exists as well. If you ever want to go through there and poke through an archive of 4 years of very specific daily comics blog updates, you can get lost for several hours on all the work that's still on there.
Right on. Well, Zach, thank you so much for coming on the show and best of luck with the campaign.
Thank you guys. Great questions. The Velocipede Pastor, like no one else has asked about that. So that was a lot of fun to talk about. And I got to tell my Walmart mattress return shame story. Anyway, back to campaign, please. Thank you.
That's it for this week's show. As a reminder, WMQ&A is part of ComicsXF, where you can find this podcast along with our sister podcasts, Battle of the Atom and Bat Chat with Matt and Will, a Batman ranking podcast co-hosted by Matt Lazowitz and Will Nevin. You can listen to WMQ&A on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, Amazon Music, Audible, and at comicsxf.com, where new episodes move Tuesday mornings. You can support ComicsXF at patreon.com/comicsxf, where a $1 donation gets you a shout out at the end of every episode of WMQ&A. A $2 donation gets you early access to WMQ&A and a shout out at the end of every episode. A $3 donation gets you a sticker, early access, and a shout out. A $5 donation gets you access to our monthly bonus podcast, Our Son Pete, a deep dive into the comic appearances of British mutant super spy Pete Wisdom. A $25 donation lets you request a primer, one of our custom reading guides for a series, character, or creator. And a $50 donation lets you advertise on the show. Big thanks to our patrons, Joel Elod, Shelf Dust, Lisa Slack, Will Redman, Tobias Carroll, Mike Sagawa, Will Nevin, Liz Large, Asimov Fangirl, Carla Pacheco, and Robert Secundus. You're all special, and we love you. You can follow ComicsXF on Twitter at ComicsXF, me at Daniel P. Grote, and Matt Lazowitz at MattLaz1013. You can also follow ComicsXF on Facebook, Instagram, and Blue Sky. And until next week, remember, a supervillain once tried to trick Superman and Big Barda into making a sex tape.
WMQA.